This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Living free.
Thanks to the Resident Frequency Radio crew for another great show playing tracks and chatting with Collingwood artists. Welcome to Living Free, a one-hour show in which we highlight one of the many programs that assist in recovery from drugs, alcohol, gambling and food addictions. Our guests share their recovery story and highlight that shared experience saves lives. You're listening to 3CR Community Radio, 855 on your AM dial, or 3CR Digital, or maybe even live streaming on 3cr.org.au. My name's Michael, and I'm joined in the studio by my guest John, who's going to share his experience of recovery from alcoholism with the help of Alcoholics Anonymous. But before we do that, I would like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, traditional owners of the land from which 3CR transmits people-powered radio. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and acknowledge that this land was stolen and sovereignty was never ceded. Also, please note that the Living Free show may involve discussion of topics such as suicide, mental illness, self-harm and family violence. Please consider your well-being and that of others while listening. Welcome, John.
Thanks, Michael. Yeah, I'm John. I'm an alcoholic.
Awesome. It's great to have you here. Thanks for joining us in the studio. We'd like to start the show by asking our guests to tell us a little bit about their upbringing and their childhood. So what was it like to grow up as John?
I'm old now, I can't hardly remember, which is really a bright spot. I grew up in the southern suburbs of Melbourne, very middle class, Catholic mother, very religious, and an immigrant father who I kind of figured might be a bit of a rat bag, and I reckon it was his war zone. That was the best way of putting it, but, you know, I've been sober a long time. I've had a lot of time to think about my childhood, and I reckon I lived a double life right from the beginning. I was an older boy at one thing, and then involved in scouts and sports and all that sort of stuff. And then I learned a way to steal, you know, bob a job in scouts. I learned a way to manipulate the money and steal the money. That's pretty much the way I lived, and be nice one way and then shifty as soon as the back was turned, and getting out of trouble was, you know, and was a great feed of what I did, you know, and yeah, that two-facedness, I reckon that's how I grew up, and you know, and yeah, anything, you know, like problems running, I had a lot of problems too, run away, I just couldn't be told, so I was really, you know, like, I don't like to use ADHD or whatever because that wasn't used back then.
Yeah,
I was just a rat bag, that was the way it was called, and
easily distracted.
Yeah, if you want to look at it that way, it was just, when I was a kid, I had two brothers who were a couple of years younger than me, and we built a bike track out the back of the house because we all had backyards in those days, and we learned a way of just riding that bike track the whole time.
Yeah.
And, you know, and even getting called in for dinner or just going, no, I'm not coming in. So it was kind of like I'd have to be dragged in, and so to me it was like, and at the end of the day, I didn't know any difference because that's what it was. This is what it was. And as I grew up, you know, I went from Catholic primary school to a state high school, and it was like, you want to be the odd person out, do that.
Yep.
You know, having to, yeah, it's just chalk and cheese and
different disciplines?
Yeah. You know, like the Catholic religion, primary school was very strict. You know, you move, you get the strap.
Yep.
You know, which happened to quite a lot. And then you go to high school and, you know, and like, you know, it was just people that have their cigarettes in their jumpers, you know, and it was like sending me to a lolly shop, and I had a field day in it, and, you know, and that's what happened as I grew older. And so, yeah, and I just drifted from one thing. Like, no, but then in the end, you know, I like I said, I lived that double life. So when I was 15, I was captain of Mentone under 16's cricket team. Played serious cricket in the afternoon at the seniors. I had a part-time job pumping petrol. A girlfriend at school. I went to school.
Hey.
That was all at 15. You know, I was an average kid, really, and it was just,
What happened?
I drank.
Ooh. Ooh, what happened when you drank?
I no longer had worry about whether, you know, I was two-faced or not. I just, you know, I often say I became the Antichrist straight away. Mm. I didn't do anything special. I went down the Edgewater Hotel with a group of kids from school because it's a notorious place where you could drink underage. They'd serve you.
Yep.
You know, the bikies were in the front bar and the disco with the time warp going on was in the back and it was full of underage 18-year-olds.
Yep.
And it was easy to get in. It was easy to get a drink. And that's when I discovered liquor and that became my life. You know, it's very quickly...
Why? What happened? What happened when you drank? What does alcohol do when you're that young? And for you, what did it do for you?
Well, where I was had gone.
Yep.
You know, I was not where I was. So, I look back. I've had a lot of time to look at it. You know, that fear or that insecurities or that, you know, that not quite sureness or trying to survive went straight out the window.
Yep.
And I was like, I was just lit up. I was alive.
Yeah.
And I can remember because these guys would be sitting there playing Space Invaders, talking and joking.
Yeah.
And I was gravitated to the table closest to the bar.
Yep.
Because that's where the booze was.
Yep.
And it was right from day one. And, you know, I couldn't get what they were doing and wasn't interested. I was interested where I was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was the drinking happening at your house? Like, were your family drinkers?
Yeah, my old man was. He worked in bars and everything, but and I can't call him an alcoholic because he drank different to me.
Yeah,
you know, it wasn't until I started drinking he might have been a heavy drinker, but geez, he drank different to me. Because right from the start, you know, so I was there, and we had always socially out with people down the street and all that sort of thing, and you know, like barbecues, very social, middle class.
Yeah.
You know, they're always out.
Did you get drunk the first time you drank?
Yeah. I would have sworn black and blue I wasn't. You know, I wasn't that bad.
Yeah.
Didn't affect me. I was okay.
Was there consequences?
When they shut the bar.
Mm.
Yeah, because I know today when they shut that bar, I had to go out the front and I didn't know at the time. I wanted to keep drinking.
Yep.
And they shut the bar on me and all hell broke loose.
You bet.
You know, I abused some girl because she wouldn't take me home. Then I punched on with her boyfriend. And I hadn't spoken to her. Yep. I hadn't spoken to anybody that night because I was drinking.
Yep.
And then, you know, broke down to my best mate saying nobody loved me. And that's all I can remember from that night.
Mm.
And I can remember the next day when I went to school and everyone was talking about around about 11 o'clock and everyone was talking what a great night it was and I couldn't remember.
Wow.
And, and I couldn't wait to go back and do it the next week and I did.
Yeah.
You know, and it became my way of life and my solution to that was I would go home to my old man's bar and pinch a bottle out of it.
Yep.
So I could keep drinking to the early hours.
Wow. So, that kicked in early, that physical thing that makes you different.
For me it was, yeah. Yeah, it was... Straight away, it was like, you know, I often wonder because, you know, I remember when I was a kid, you know, we my brother took me with his friends one time, we lit up Mentone Beach to watch the fire trucks come, you know, so that's how dodgy I was. And I remember how much I absolutely crapped myself when I saw the fire trucks coming. I knew the damage that could be done. And I ran away and I never did it again. The fear was intense. But when I drank, it was...
Jekyll and Hyde.
It wasn't there. It was like, you know, all right, this is it. I'm off, you know. And it became the centerpiece of my life straight away.
Wow.
You know, right from the beginning, you know.
And so how did your family react to that?
Who cares?
There's an answer to the question that isn't who cares.
I know a couple of years of drinking, I got sent overseas to my grandfather. My old man sent me over there to straighten me out because he'd grown up in the war. And he was a hard man and, you know, and my drinking was a problem by 16, 17. They'd sent me over there and I spent 2 weeks there and they had to ship me off to an uncle's place because I went out and drank straight away. I was out of control then and...
In a strange place, in another country.
Couldn't speak the language.
Awesome.
But I knew how to get a drink. And more importantly, they knew how to speak. Some of them knew how to speak English.
Yep.
So I was right. You know, and you could drink at 16 in Holland.
Yep.
You know, and this is before they legalized drugs then, but at 16, you could drink at 16. So I was in my element.
Mm.
They couldn't stop me. And, you know, and I didn't blink an eyelid. And I got shipped around and then sent back home to Australia, you know. And, it was my life at that point.
Yeah. And so was there shame attached with that when you sort of got back where you didn't give a shit or?
No, because I just kept drinking.
Yeah.
I just moved on to the next, you know, like next part of my life, that where the drink was.
Yep.
There was a lot of, like, I know my parents had to lock me out of the house, and we had an old, I often laugh about this, we had an old garage. Now, whether it had that asbestos on the walls, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't have any glass in the windows.
Yep.
And it didn't have any of the plasterboard on the walls.
Yep.
And it had holes in the floorboards and even holes in the side. And they set my bed up out there, so because I could come and go. This is at 16. I could come and go as I liked.
Wow.
Because they couldn't control me at that point. You know, I at 16 I was, you know, that life I was living, I often think about it, was gone.
Yeah.
And alcohol had become the centerpiece of it, and, you know, and it just, I'd drift from one thing to another, you know, it was always centered around, at 16 it was centered around that.
Yeah, and so, and you're still earning enough money to do that? Or are you now changing your life to a life of crime?
I'd always had a life of crime, you know, But it had gotten worse. You know, I lost that part-time job at 15 because, you know, it'd be $2 for the petrol I'd pumped and $10 into my pocket because I'd have to drink. That was the way it was. And, I that life that I lived at 15, that girlfriend that left school, stopped playing cricket. I went from the being serious to bottom grade mats because I could drink on the field. And, I left school. Yeah, and the job had gone too.
Wow.
So I'd learned to steal, lie. And I always had an old man that had a bar.
Yep.
And it's amazing how much you could fill water up into things. I remember one time he got this precious bottle from Italy of this white liquid thing, and I filled it up, and I took, and it tasted like crap, but I drank it, a fair bit of it, and I filled it up with water, and it got mold in it and started to develop mold. And it's like, well, I better not come home for a while then, you know. I was a nightmare, you know. And it was, I'm a parent now, and, you know, and I was a parent now, and I know, geez, you know, what I did, you know. I never understood what I did, but, geez, I get it now.
And you get to watch it terrorise your family. We might take a break. We'll come back because I know where the story goes a little bit in the next bit, but we'll play a song and we'll come back after a break. You're listening to Living Free on 3CR Community Radio, 855 on AM radio or 3CR on digital radio or maybe even live streaming on 3cr.org.au. We would encourage our listeners to become a regular donor to 3CR. By becoming a regular donor, on your ongoing support ensures that we can continue to provide a platform for community issues and struggles. Jump online and go to 3cr.org.au to become a regular donor or call the station during business hours on 9419 8377. Today we're talking with John about alcoholism and his recovery through Alcoholics Anonymous. And before the break, you gave us some insight into your introduction to alcohol, and maybe we'll just keep going with you're 16 or 17, you're living in the garage or the granny flat or whatever it was at the back of the house, and I imagine it didn't get better.
Did for a little while. I joined the Navy. Ooh. I got in because my old man at that point was really trying to push me to get a job, like, you know, PMG and all that sort of stuff. I don't know what that, work for the government or stuff like that. So I went off and did all these tests. I remember getting into the Navy. And, I went off to join the Navy, and somehow I got in, and, you know, and I was lucky in that sense because I was able to drink the way I wanted to and get away with it. And, eventually, I got into a lot of trouble, and eventually, you know, they had to let me go because they couldn't keep covering me up. And from that point on, you know, I, and at that point I thought, you know, that my problems were my old man. you know, my family, where I grew up, all that sort of stuff. And that particular area, you know, joining the Navy, I got a girlfriend and you know, and I was doing, I said I was okay because I was doing what I liked and therefore it'd be, I'd be okay. And what I found was, no, my drinking, you know, I learned to drink at 10 o'clock on a Saturday and Sunday, Saturday morning, you know, back in those days, because that's what I discovered, you know. So it got worse in that sort of sense. You know, I drank more. I learned to drink more. I had more money. I could drink more often. And I could get away with stuff. That's what I found. And but it really didn't matter. Once I was drinking, it was in me. I was off.
Yeah, and the care factor drops.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, so it's not so much that, you know, it's out of control, but I don't care about the consequences anyway, so I'll keep going.
Yeah. And from then on, once I got out of there, it was, you know, I remember they sent me off. I had to see a psychologist if I wanted to stay in, and or I could be free to go and unsuitable discharge. And you know, I saw the psychologist once and decided, oh, I'll take the unsuitable, thanks.
Yeah.
And I was off. There was no, you know, it definitely got worse after that. It was, you know, drinking was just what I did all the day, and I became a street drinker. You know, and
how old were you then?
It was about 19 or 20. Yep. 19, 20.
And where were you then by the time?
In Melbourne. Still? I was back in Melbourne. I was down, you know, I remember being down Fitzroy Street, St Kilda, one time down in the park, down there drinking. And one night the Salvation Army tried to take me home. And I had to, you know, tell them where I lived and wrong street and jump the back fence to get away from them. And what I found was that, you know, my mind went on going to Sydney, just like that. No thought about it. I ended up moving to Sydney and found that I could drink the way I wanted to. Lived on the streets, and just drink the way I wanted to, and didn't give a second thought.
Interesting lifestyle choice, isn't it?
Well, I didn't know at the time. It was the most natural thing to do.
Yeah,
you know, the concept of stopping or giving up or getting a job and not doing it was, I wasn't doing it anymore.
Yeah.
You know, it was...
complete surrender.
Yeah. And that's where it took me. Yeah. And, you know, and then, yeah, and I was able to drink that way I wanted to drink. Move up and down the coast of Australia, you know, drink for long periods of time, you know, live a lifestyle that, you know, like, lifestyle that, you know, I could justify by doing it.
Yep.
You know, because I'd come to the point there was something seriously wrong with me, and I could justify what I could do.
So what happened then? What happened? What brought you to your knees and made a decision to stop?
Stupid decision. I ended up in a blackout back in Melbourne. And, you know, one Saturday night, it was early in the year. I don't know how long I'd been drinking for or where I'd been drinking, but I was at the Morty Alec Hotel and I met this girl. And apparently I couldn't stand up. I was on my knees dancing, which, you know, was pretty much normal. And I spent the night with this girl, and the next morning I'm walking out as my brother's walking, because she was a friend of my brother's, and he said, I hope you're not going to crap on this one. And I went, oh, no, no. And I decided to go back and, you know, I was going to stop drinking. I decided I was going to stop drinking and do the right thing, like, you know, get a job, all that sort of stuff that normal people do. And I was dead set certain on it.
Yep.
And I was adamant I was going to stop. I lasted 6 days.
Yep.
And they were the worst 6 days of my life.
You bet.
Until I got to AA, I could tell you. But they were tough. And I put my, you know, I picked up a drink and put my hand through a window and tried it again, lasted 5 days and couldn't do it. And, you know, and that last 10 months, I was to drink for another 10 months. And, you know, I ended up living on the Murray in a tent.
Yep.
Drinking Fruity Moselle, which, you know, was not out of, you know, that silver cast sort of thing.
Yep.
You know, it was not, you know, I'd gone up there to do a job through the old CES as an orange farmer.
Yep.
And I tipped the tractor on the first day and that was it. I didn't go back. Lived on the Murray you know, and drinking fruit, and that was
highlight the peak of your existence,
because there was no tomorrow.
Now I get it.
There was no. This is what it was going to be like, and there was no stopping point.
And you were all of 22.
22. Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So what happened next? So what's your experience of coming to AA?
Basically, at the end of my drinking, I'd gone from there back to Melbourne, you know, and I was living in a caravan park, and I had somebody who was looking after me, because I was a pass-out drunk in the caravan park, and I got dragged home for Christmas Day, 85, yeah, Christmas Day, and, you know, I didn't want to go. I got dragged in there, and at this stage of my drinking, my tolerance to alcohol had gone. I was basically have one drink and pass out.
Yep.
Or two drinks and pass out and come to and drink again. And this particular day, Christmas Day, I was at home, and then I went out to people's places, and I was able to drink like I did in the good old days a lot.
Yeah.
The only difference was I didn't black out. And I remember thinking how obnoxious I was, you know, that seeing how obnoxious I was and thinking, well, okay, yeah. And basically, the early hours of the morning, I'm standing on the Nepean Highway, you know, in front of waiting for a car to hit me. And that's when I blacked out and ended up on the nature strip and, you know, went home to my parents' house and tried, you know, decided a good idea to try and kill them.
Yep.
Which is apparently not unusual when I drank.
Yep.
And, you know, got restrained. And basically, I was put into a room, and I sat in that room, and it was the early hours of the morning, and you know, and the door was locked on me, and I wasn't allowed, you know. And basically, I remember sitting there thinking, well, you know, I could bulldust my way out of this. Yep. I could talk my way out of what had just happened.
Wow.
And I'm sitting there, and I realised I couldn't. I'd had enough. And that was the thing. I then slept after that, and I got up the next morning and got told I was they rung Lifeline, and that I, you know, and this is 85. This is not this decade. This is 1985, and you know, they was going out to Moorabbin Hospital to get taken out to Larundel, and I said, yeah, okay,
yep.
And I got, as I was getting in the car, apparently the phone rang, and it was a guy, you know, from AA, because you know that the night before they'd asked had I been drinking, and my old man had said, yeah. And it was a guy from AA, and you know, my parents gave me the choice of about, did I want to go and speak to this guy, or did I want to go out to the hospital to get locked up? And I just shrugged my shoulders. I yep. couldn't give an answer. So they made the decision to go and speak to this guy. And I ended up going to, I'd never heard of AA, nor was I very interested in it. If I had heard of it, I wouldn't have been interested. And did a couple of minute meetings at Richmond Unity that night. And I remember going to Dandenong the next day, on the Saturday, and going out to Dandenong, and, you know, I haven't had a drink since.
Yeah.
You know, and that was the start, you know.
Yeah. So what did the early days look like? You've come to AA. I know you, so I know the answer to this question, but, you know, what did the early days look like?
Best way to sum it up was that I got taken to the doctors to get checked out, and I had to go to the doctors every day to get a vitamin B shot or C, which I don't know which one it was, because the doctor didn't trust me to take the tablet.
Yep.
And I had to do that for the whole first month.
Yep.
And I ate potato chips. That's all I could stomach for the first month.
Wow.
That, you know, like Smith's crisps, that's all I could eat.
They're potatoes. It's all my salad.
Yeah. you know, and I did a meeting. I did a meeting every day.
Yep.
You know, and I spent a lot of time just getting on trains. Back in those days, you know, I had paper tickets, so I jumped the train from this train to that one and just go to meeting after meeting after meeting.
Fill in the days.
Yeah. And I think, too, the only relief I got from where I was in a meeting.
Yep.
I might not have recognised it, but I felt, you know, that once I walked out of a meeting, my head would start up and it would just be like, under.
AA was different back then as well. There was the message that was necessarily being carried at that particular time was about going to meetings and not drinking.
Yeah.
There was a lot of that. I mean, there's still a lot of that around, but it was a lot of the message that the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and other things like that weren't necessarily...
They weren't talked about.
No.
They weren't talked about from the floor. Richmond Unity at that time had started their thing, and that was the first outreach of the speaker meetings.
Yeah.
And they copped a lot of that flack.
Because they bought it from America.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, it was very American.
Yeah. But I also didn't know how sick I was.
Yeah.
You know, I was 22 and I weighed 49 kilos and I didn't know what my name was, and I could barely remember the fact that I drank.
Mm.
And I needed to hear that repetition.
Yep.
You know, and people used to talk to me about different things, and it'd be like, you know, I'd run out of the room. I just couldn't be around. And it took a long, long time for me to settle. You know, I sometimes see people come through the doors like that today, and
yeah,
they're nowhere near as often as what they were back then. But, very sick.
People come through treatment centres and, you know, rehabs or detoxes or, yeah, you know, it's not initially the place to come from. You know, the people have been somewhere else and they've come to AA as the place of last resort.
Yeah.
After having tried other stuff and so I was having this conversation with someone earlier today that the people who just come in off the street and decide I've got a drinking problem, I'm going to AA, are unusual. You know, would love to have them there. You know, but usually people have tried everything else and tried a lot of other things before they get there. So that obviously worked for you. I mean, the fact that you filled in your time. How'd you make a living? How were you surviving? Where were you living?
Oh, I lived from place to place. I actually slept in the park quite often too, in the warmer months.
Yep.
I slept at friends' houses.
Yep.
That shed that my parents, that I was allowed to stay there.
Yep.
So I didn't have any expenses.
Yep.
My first job was with an AA member, and he used to, I think, give me $5 a day, and he'd work me for an hour or two, and then he'd tell me to go and meet him.
Excellent.
I remember that. You know, still today, that is one of the greatest gifts.
As I say, it's an act of love, isn't it? That's the best you had, and that's all that was asked of you.
Yeah, and then he'd just say, go to a meeting. You're done. Go to a meeting for the day. And it was survival. You know, I know there was, for me, it was just surviving. It was, you know, it was tough. It was, you know, I like I said, you know, I didn't know if I wanted to be sober or not. It was hard. And, but I had no other, you know, I didn't really have another choice. And I suppose if I had a choice, I would have taken that other choice. You know, I remember I used to get all these bills coming in the first couple of years, and I'd go and get a job. You know, like work in a factory, and you know, and I was still lying back then, you know, because to get more tax money, I'd be saying, you know, that I'm married with three kids, so I could, you know, pay less tax, and you know, and different name, just so I could get cash, and this is before computers took over, and I all this lying still, but what happened was that once that money was paid off, that bill, like the bank card that came in, I paid the bank card off, I'd stop going to work.
Yep.
I didn't have that mental capacity sober to be able to, geez, you know, maybe, you know, I should learn how to work.
Yeah.
That took a lot longer. It took 8 year mark for that sort of thing.
Yep.
And I learned that by washing dishes in a kitchen.
Yep.
Yeah, from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. And it was like, you know, tough shift, but I learned that attitude, geez, you turn up to go to work. You know, before that it was like, I couldn't do it.
No, I get it.
You know?
Cool. I'm actually going to take a break a bit earlier than normal because we'll talk about what life looks like and what changed in your AA life when we come back. And you're listening to Living Free on 3CR People Powered Radio. I understand that's a promotion from September, but as I said, paying the bills to maintaining our studios to training the next generation of community broadcasters, regular donors are vital to keeping us on air. So if you're willing to become a regular donor, please go to 3cr.org.au or call the station during business hours on 9419 8377. Today we're talking with John about alcoholism and his recovery through Alcoholics Anonymous, and we sort of got to a stage, you're in AA, you said it took 8 years I think the language in AA would be for the fog to clear. You know, to get well enough to know what the real problem is and what happened next.
What happened next? I reckon I felt okay about not drinking. That was the biggest thing. I don't know about the fog, but I was okay about not drinking. It wasn't torment every day. But I was running around AA trying to figure out what the hell was wrong with me, you know, and I remember back then there was the big push in, you know, like I didn't, you know, not just AA, but I went to every 12-step fellowship that existed because I fitted into them all.
Yep.
Trying to figure, you know, figure out what the hell's wrong with me. And, you know, and I did weekends away and all this sort of stuff. And I happened to do a workshop one time and, you know, and because I'm watching people get committed to AA and doing things. And but I couldn't do that. I was so arm's reach from it. And I did this workshop and relationships and, you know, and it was like we all did role playing. And it was on the sun, and I was the last person to do it, thinking, well, you know, there's this role-playing therapy stuff going on, and I'm thinking, well, you know, there's nothing wrong with me. And, you know, and I did this, and I, you know when you open Pandora's box, you can't put the lid back on? That's what happened. And the thing was that I could never remember what had happened to me in the past, so it was like my mind shut everything out.
Yep.
That after that particular workshop, it didn't.
Yep.
So the next 2 years, I remember thinking how, you know, it was just, it was horrendous. You know, I was under care virtually every day.
Yep.
I forget how bad that was. You know, I'd see psychologists every day. I was in that much trouble.
And so were you. You're 30 years old and, you know.
Yeah, and all hell had broken loose in my head. Childhood that I could never remember it come flashing back.
Yep.
You know, and I went through that period and my involvement in AA decreased at that point.
Yep.
To a certain degree because it was about not drinking. AA was about not drinking.
Yep.
And this stuff had to be dealt with.
Yep.
And via that my life changed.
Yeah.
And I can fast forward it, you know, I'm somebody that couldn't read and write when I come to AA and learnt to read and write and end up getting 2 degrees. But, you know, I started to live a life that I couldn't do or never wanted to do anyway.
Yeah.
Like, you know, get a job, hold a job down, pay rent, pay bills, all that sort of stuff people do naturally happened in that point.
Yeah, wow.
So basically I'll fast forward to the 25-year point, you know, and, you know. And,
okay,
and
so that's 2010. 2010.
There you go.
God, you're an old man.
Yeah. And basically I'm, you know, my life has improved. I've got a life today. I had a life, you know. I hear it in the rooms, oh, it's not the life I chose, but it's a life. And it's still not the life I would have chosen. But, but you know, I've got this. I've got a partner. I've got kids.
Not even kids anymore.
Sorry?
They're a bit older than kids now.
Yeah. Yeah, well, they're adults now.
Yeah.
And basically, you know, to put it in a nutshell, I met another woman and I had an experience. And although I was not unfaithful, I had an experience with that woman that is as close to drinking as I'd ever experienced in my life. And that unlocked Pandora's box again.
Yep.
It was like, you know, it was like I wanted this and I wanted her more than anything. And it really, you know, it triggered off the alcoholism.
Yep.
And that's when I got serious about the AA program.
Yeah. Because I think the language, isn't it, though, like my alcoholism shows up when I put down the drink. It's not a problem when I'm drinking. I'm treating my alcoholism with alcohol. Yeah. And when I'm not treating it with anything, then I'm open to obsession and just to obsession of the mind about anything and everything, because I need to be right out of right here, right now. I need to be doing something else because nothing's comfortable.
And I found something that was close to it as possible.
Get that.
And, you know, I wanted it. And, you know, and since then I discovered, 25 years in, I discovered I was a real alcoholic.
Wow.
To put it simply, you know, that, and, you know, I've started to get fair dinkum about what it is. You know, sometimes, you know, sometimes it's, you know, I've started to get fair dinkum and.
So what does that look like? So I love you because I like the fact that you don't want to do it and you do it. Like I love your discipline about doing things, doing stuff you don't want to do and grumbling about it. I like, and I love that because I feel exactly the same way. I go, oh, it's not a choice. It's like it's life and death. And if I want to have the things that are in my life and I want to feel connected to other people, and because I've now got people in my life I have to be connected to.
Yeah.
And so how am I going to do that? Because I have no skill set to do it. And I watch you do it and I go, like, that's so attractive to me. So what do you do?
Because the action's greater than anything else I can do.
Mm.
You know, and I'm so grateful today that when I first came in, they told me don't drink and go to meetings. And I did that action because it's the action that changes it. Doesn't matter if I want to do it or not.
Yeah.
If I take the action, something's going to happen. If I don't take the action, something's going to happen.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're thinking about it has never changed it.
No.
You know, that's the thing. I wish I could, but...
I wish I could just have this mental sort of not real at all, you know, this...
And I've had a really strange experience in the last... Well, I've already half forgotten about in the last couple of days about that sort of... About that, you know, this recovery stuff and seeking God. You know, I've been so disciplined that I'm only starting now to feel that comfort about seeking God.
Mm.
You know, oh, yes, I want this. You know, like I've got this work situation that, you know, I come here today because if it wasn't the work situation, didn't blow up last week, I wouldn't be here.
Mm.
But all of a sudden I'm finding myself looking for this comfort, you know, that I go, I'm a regular believer in going back through the process now. You know, I wasn't when I first started. If I could get away with doing it once, I would.
Yep.
But I find that I get comfortable again and I have to go back and do it. Yeah. And that changes the things that I don't want to change.
I guess, and if we describe what the process is this of looking at my behaviours and seeing where I'm angry and where I'm resentful and what other people are doing and it's driving me insane and the fears that drive me and the things that back me into a corner and make me make poor decisions because I'm so concerned about the outcomes.
Yeah.
And I make poor decisions backed into corners, but I allow myself to be backed into a corner out of fear. But if I don't watch it, I'm there. I'm in the corner. I have no choice. But I can watch myself being backed in and go, actually, I don't need to be doing this backward walking.
And today I'm at that point where I can go through this process and go, oh, it's okay.
Mm.
It's finally got to that point where, you know, oh, yes, it's okay what's happening. It's okay. You know, it's not long fighting it the whole time that, you know, that, oh, what's going to happen? But it's okay. Mm. And from that I get the relief. You know, and what I find is that, you know, like, yeah, I'm even comfortable starting to seek this thing, you know, if you want to call, I don't know if I call it God, but seek this ease and comfort. It's that, the torment that is in my head when I'm on my own, not doing this stuff, the torment drops off and I start to seek this, you know, like this work situation I've got. I'm here today doing this, and I know true well if I'm looking to seek this stuff because it's a solution. I know that logically. But I've also got my work situation. I've got 50 different outcomes that I'm ready to pounce on once I know what happens.
Yep.
You know, once they show me a little bit of light, I'm on this one.
You bet.
Yeah, and then I'm going to move on to the next one. So I worry myself sick about doing that stuff.
Yep.
You know, and that's where I'll remain sick.
Yep.
But I find if I come and do what's put in front of me, you know, and that's what's seeking it, and I'm finding myself wanting to do this now, wanting to do it more.
Yeah.
You know? And although I still want to get them. Yeah.
Well, the problem is definitely them. Yeah. And yep, so. Absolutely understand that. And you know, AA's shown, for me, has shown me this way of doing things, doing life, not thinking life. It hasn't necessarily changed a lot of my thinking, but a lot of my thinking is still inside my head. Whereas it used to be, if I thought it, I acted it.
Yeah.
And the problem was that if I thought something, it was playing out in your life. And today, that thinking can still be happening, but the discipline of changing my behaviour, because it's a behaviour change program, is that I'm actually going to behave in a different way to how I think, and the outcome will be okay because my motives are better.
Yeah.
And not being a slave to the way I think is just the freedom that comes from that is enormous.
Yeah, and that's what I find, that you know, I think it, I automatically believe it. I don't even question. I'm amazed that, you know, that it's already there, but I don't even know it yet.
Yeah.
I'm just waiting for the next wave to come, a life thing to come, and I'll automatically believe what I think, you know, and then I can't understand why I get into trouble all the time.
And that's the sort of stuff. And so that sort of thinking, when we're relying on our thinking, is the sort of stuff that leads us back to drinking. And and for people like us, to drink is to die. And it doesn't look like life and death for everybody else. So, because you haven't had a drink for such a long time, for 40 years, and you say, coming up on 40 years, so you sort of go, oh, well, it doesn't look like a drinking problem. And you go, actually, but that's what's at the end of the road if I don't do this other stuff. Like, we've got some freedoms around the things that we choose to do today, or not choose not to do.
Yeah.
Because if once I get back to drinking, I have no freedoms at all. I have no choice. I can't allow that to come up.
And something I often hear too is that the pain level today.
Yeah.
You know, when I first came into AA, you could have cut my arm off and I wouldn't have felt any pain. That's how pickled I was.
Yeah.
Today, I can feel a lot of pain pretty quickly.
Yeah.
That emotional, that mental torment pretty quickly. And, you know, and that's a great driving force into actually having to do something.
Yeah.
Because I can't handle that pain.
Yeah, we can't sit in it for anywhere near as long.
And I don't like doing the things I did, you know, I'll do in life. You know, I don't like picking fights with my partner.
Yeah.
You know, or saying something about her sister that, you know, really doesn't need to be said. I had to practice one time keeping my mouth shut for 6 months with her. And I tell you, didn't she try and bait me to get an argument? You know, and I was so glad when that 6 months off, because I actually able to do, you know. What I found was that I don't go as far with what I say to her.
Yep.
And I've learned not to comment on a lot of things in her life.
Yep.
Just let her be.
I remember you going to the movies when you didn't want to go to the movies.
I still do that. She said that this weekend, you know, would you like to go to the movies? Yes.
Awesome.
What movie? Whatever you like. You know, I didn't say that, but you know, I'll go to the movies, you know. And the funny thing about that is that the kids, the last couple of times, the kids have come with us, you know, and they're 23 and 20 now. And, you know, and my daughter's moved out and my son's leave his girlfriend at her house. And, and basically they will come with us to the movies, and you know, and it's just something that's happened.
Yeah,
you know,
and in that sense, it's not the reason we come to AA.
No,
is to have this family life.
No,
it wasn't on the cards. It wasn't on the table. It wasn't an option at all. And you go, oh, actually, now they're the things. I think that the way they've described to me is that I'm going to have a life beyond my wildest dreams, and the only thing that's changed is my dreams. My dreams of what would be beyond my wildest dreams have just changed. I go, actually, I've changed what my priorities are, because previously the priority was alcohol, and then everything else came second. And then I had to, and gradually over time, all that's happened is my priorities have changed.
My dreams go into my dishonesty, because you know my dreams are all about me.
Yep.
No one else but me, and that's where it ends up.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks for coming in and joining me. It's been a joy for me. That's all we've got time for today. If you'd like to find out more about Alcoholics Anonymous, then you can phone them on 1-300-222-222, or you could go online to aa.org.au. I'd like to thank John for coming in and sharing his experience of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous.
Thanks, Michael.
You've done it great. And I hope that you'll be able to join us again next week, when I think it's Anne who'll be talking to someone about their recovery in Al-Anon. Coming up next, we have Balamoir, The Spirit of War, hosted by Uncle Talgum Choco Edwards. And join Uncle Choco in The Spirit of War on a journey of belonging and movement through sing-alongs and yarns. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. Stay tuned. And now for more Radical Radio on 3CR, and we'll take it out with some music.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.